This is Circe Olson Wessner, and I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. It's the month of the military child, and I'm speaking to military brat and military spouse, Jesse Higa. Hi, Jesse. Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. Aloha, Circe. Thank you for welcoming me on your podcast.
So, for our listeners, I want to share with them that you're a wealth of information about the people who lived, worked, and died on the island of Oahu during World War II. You're also the co-founder of the Hickam Historical Society and do walking tours and guest lectures and create informational pamphlets. And I saw somewhere online that you also teach laymaking. So how is it you became so interested in Hawaiian history and culture?
Well, I'm a military child, and because I have Hawaiian ancestral roots, my mother is part Native Hawaiian, Chinese, and Japanese. So whenever we came home in between PCS seasons and traveling, we would come home to Hawaii every year, and my grandfather was Hawaiian. Felt it was very important that I learn about my culture. Mm. So part of that is learning how to make lei, learning about the language and the history of the Hawaiian people on the, you know, what is now today state of Hawaii. And eventually over time, as I went to college at the University of Hawaii, I became interested in not Hawaiian history, but military history, which ended up at the job at the Park Service in 1991 as an intern. So imagine I was there for the 5th of Remembrance, and my grandfather built military bases around Oahu from 1936 to 1941. So I was very steeped in the history and where the two converged, because the lands at one time did belong to the Native Hawaiians. Mm-hmm. And it's through that progression and being a military child myself and very military and then living on a base that my grandpa built, it just became part of who I was and am today. So we created this Hickam Historical Society, which first was a club, and I did not do it alone. The other co-founder was my friend, Ms. Barbara Coughlin, and we saw that there was an interest in not just the architecture of our historical buildings on Hickam Field, but also the provenance of who lived in those homes in regards to 7 December. So we together put our thinking caps on and background with history and her acumen for researching, and we started to do this incredible service to the base to provide information, teachings, and preservation about our base history. But because of joint basing, when it happened, the Air Force side got absorbed in the Navy side, and they had no other choice to start cracking down on, you know, clubs and organizations that were operating on base. You know, it had to be, you know, I guess you can say monitored. And it was just a little too much after Bard PCS'd, and for me to handle it all on my own and all the, you know, nonprofit standards that you're familiar with in operating such an incredible operation to help with history, it became too much. So we are now a on hold organization, but we are still prevalent doing the work that we do as volunteers on the base, but just unofficially. And so that's how we are today, just continuing to do what we do, but behind the scene.
Well, that's very cool. So let's begin our conversation with your brathood. So was your mother or your father the service member, and what branch were you guys?
My father graduated from the University of Hawaii, where he met my mom, and he was Air Force ROTC, so I was born into the Air Force.
Okay. So where all did you live when you were growing up? I know you lived here in Hawaii for a bit, but where else did you live?
Well, I was born in Wichita Falls, Texas, Shepherd Air Force Base. I'm very proud of my 450, you know, beginning of my social. And I always... Texan, you know, it wasn't until I think I was 6 years old that someone told me I was Asian, and I didn't know what that meant. I said, no, I'm Texan. And so, Texas, California, back to Texas, then Iran. So imagine, we lived in Tehran, Iran.
Wow.
And then we moved to Maryland,
uh-huh,
and Air Force Base, and then from there to Yokota Air Base, Japan, where I graduated high school. So then I came to the University of Hawaii for college. So that's pretty much where we've been. But through that, I will say, being stationed overseas, my mom, who loved to travel and herself is quite the historian, we actually went to places like China. Like, you know, we visited Korea, South Korea, Okinawa. We learned about our ancestors, because I'm fifth generation Japanese on my grandmother's side. We went to where they immigrated in the 1880s to Hawaii to work in the plantations. So that was pretty amazing to be able to have the opportunity to travel, to broaden my understanding of who I am. And but American through and through, but I'm very proud of my ancestral roots.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that the military brats talk about, not knowing their roots. And you were blessed to be able to go see your ancestral homes overseas. Was that the traveling? Was that the best thing about being a military brat for you? Or what was the best thing?
I believe it was the traveling, but it's also the way of life for a military child. I had so many friends that were mixed, multiracial, and the diversity, and it was just so great to go to school where everybody was, you know, part African-American Japanese or part Caucasian Japanese or Korean and Japanese, just, you know, Caucasian or just all Japanese, some Hawaiian. It was just really great to grow up in the military where everybody was different, and yet we were all the same because we had the same lifestyle, the same opportunities, to be able to grow up overseas and learn a different language, their culture, teach each other our, also our native cultures that were in our, you know, ancestral group. People wonder, you know, how is it that, you know, as a military child, you weren't bothered by moving all the time? Well, I think that was part of the blessings. It taught me to be more resilient. It taught me to make friends easier. And I thought of it as a blessing more than an adversity. So I think that is what made me feel so blessed as a military child, is that although I may not have been able to be childhood friends with them for over a span of 5 years, those years that I spent with them were friends for a lifetime. And it's because of growing up overseas. You're very limited to what you can do off base. So your family becomes your military neighbors and your classmates. That becomes your military ohana.
Right. Well, so here's another question that a lot of brats get asked or they talk about. When you were a kid, did you feel like you were serving too? Did you feel like through volunteerism or your personal sacrifice, were you told you were an unofficial U.S. ambassador? So service, were you serving as a brat?
I felt that I was. You know, my mom always explained why my dad missed a lot of my sports events. School, you know, song contest, you know, it was just because my dad was serving his country, and part of that service was for us to support him in that and to be understanding. And I felt that in that way of sacrifice, I also too was serving. And to also understand that we are overseas and we are an example, our country, the United States of America. So my mom always reminded us, and even my friends, that whenever we were off base, we had to make sure that we were respectful, that we understood that we were visitors, and to always make sure that we gave the first good impression, because what how we acted could be now that person's understanding of what every military child was like coming from the Air Force to the military base. So, yes, I felt in many ways that whenever I conducted myself off the post, that indeed I was, in a way, an ambassador for the military, absolutely.
Well, you know, I ask those questions as kind of a segue into a conversation we had earlier this month, you know, about children serving, about the children of Pearl Harbor being pressed into service, into work right after the bombing. And so, you know, I wanted to dive into that topic and see what kind of things we can learn about these kids right at the beginning of World War II. I think it'll be really interesting.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, there are many children from every base that I have been able and blessed to study, to learn from, consider them my mentor. The Japanese attacked every military installation on Oahu. So a lot of times when you hear Pearl Harbor, the idea is myopically only think, okay, the Navy was attacked. And what they don't know is that Kaneohe Naval Air Station, Hickam Field, Wheeler Field, Bellows Field, even Schofield and Fort Shafter were strafed. There was friendly fire that happened with artillery, anti-aircraft artillery that landed all around Oahu. So it's important that I felt that I learned each story of each child child at each base. Mm-hmm. And through that, you can realize that all of them were in harm's way. Literally, military targets that the Japanese were aiming at were almost like across the street. Mm-hmm. They had every chance to bomb housing areas, to strafe the children and women as they're running around. And very interesting that from what we know, mm-hmm. Japanese bullets or bombs directly killed any minor age children and mothers. So that's where I felt these stories are important, because no one talks about the other people who were in harm's way besides those that were military.
Right.
You know, you understand that those children were witnesses to the attack, and they too were survivors themselves. So that's when I said, okay, for each base, I'm going to learn about who lived in these historical houses mm-hmm. and who were these children mm-hmm. per base, per military installation, because mm-hmm. each one has a different story. Some saw ships being sunk and exploding. Some saw aircraft on fire and men being killed in the intersections of the street. Uh-huh. So that's where I thought it was so important to be able to collectively gather all of these stories and talk about the military child, 7 December 1941.
So can you, I think we talked a little bit about how the people had been kind of preparing for a potential attack. And so when it did happen, some of the military spouses, of course, were nurses and got, you know, went up to the hospital to work. But the kids also had jobs, right? They already had sort of pre-planned things they needed to do.
It was mostly the spouses who were told, you know, here's the Red Cross, come train women. Mm-hmm. The children, though, were so brave and ready to step up to the plate to be right there next to their moms to help that they did have jobs to do. Many of them were going from house to house collecting alcohol, like whiskey, to help with the hospitals. There's a lot of alcohol have medicinal properties. Mm-hmm. Children actually there rolling bandages. They were helping belting ammunition. Can you imagine on board? We had young children as young as 6 years old helping Marines belt the ammunition because it was unbelted. And you just realize these jobs that these young children recruited themselves for and voluntarily wanted to participate is exemplary. To show that these children took on some responsibility and supported the military, that as a mother, I just can't even fathom. You know, yeah. You would think quickly get these kids off the base, but many of them stayed behind mm-hmm. to help at the hospital, to help where it was needed if they were stuck on Fort Island, so why not assist the Marines? So definitely, yes, the children had jobs that they voluntarily took part in.
Wow. So, you know, I'm here on the peninsula, and I've been reading a book that you recommended to me called Pearl Harbor Child by Dorinda Makanaonailani Nicholson. She lived right up the road from where I live now. Her house is gone, but in her book, she describes very vividly the morning that Pearl Harbor was bombed. She talks about seeing the planes flying over the peninsula over to Ford Island, which you just mentioned. Her family and other families on the peninsula got in their cars and drove up the hill to the sugarcane fields and hid there and watched the bombing take place below them. I know you have a story about a Pearl Harbor Peninsula family. Could you share that with our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. And like Dorinda's father, many had government jobs and were renting off what was known as the peninsula. Mm. There were houses that could be for rent between $30 to $45, depending. Mm. And even the military who were waiting for housing on the base were temporarily renting off base. And one family was aviation ordnanceman Ted Croft. Mm-hmm. So Theodore Croft was living at the peninsula with his wife and his stepsons. Mm-hmm. And on that morning of December 7th, he was due to go to Fort Island to just kind of, you know, check in the morning. So the sons, his stepsons were at the pier, what is today the Pan Am Clipper outpost historical area. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, got on the launch, waved goodbye to his stepsons as they're fishing in the harbor there. And they waved goodbye, and he goes across to Fort Island to hangar number 6. Mm-hmm. While he was there, the Japanese attack happened. And as they strafed through the hangar lock, he suffered several bullet wounds to the abdomen, arm, that were fatal. Mm. He was alive when the ambulance picked him up, and they rushed him to the dispensary on Ford Island, where sadly they did try to save his life, but he lost too much blood, and he was the only death on Ford Island. Many of them came to the island with their wounds and then died of their wounds later, but he's the only known true casualty on Ford Island. And the other story, Mike Wenger, he is the author of a book, Air Raid Pearl Harbor, This Is Not a Drill, an incredible historian who I am blessed to learn from. He had actually known their personal story, which goes into a little bit more detail, how one of the boys had to go home to maybe get more fish bait. And went to the house. His mom realized, what's all that commotion? And then when they looked out the window, they realized, oh my goodness, Japan's attacking. They could see the plane flying over. And then she says, where's your brother? And she was just like frantic, you know, where's your brother? And he's like, still there fishing, Mom. And she got him in the car, and she's honking the horn, trying to figure out where they were at. She's frantic. She's, you know, praying that she finds her child, and everything is happening at Ford Island, and that cacophony of explosions and sounds are coming across the water. And then as she's honking the horn so hard, it got stuck. So now you have this woman driving through Pearl City Peninsula with the horn full blast, trying to find her son. And now he pokes from the bushes, she grabs him, and then, yes, they headed out of the peninsula to safety up in the hills. So that's, again, how the women and children, they were on their own as well. They had to figure out how best to now figure out what do we do, because the husbands are either going to their battle stations or to their base. And now the women are left with the responsibility, the safety of their family.
In the book, Pearl Harbor Child, it seems like immediately, right after the bombing ended and people started going home, Hawaii went into lockdown with, just almost martial law. And I saw pictures of children going everywhere with gas masks and they had blackout curtains and things like that. Can you tell a little bit about what family life would have been during that time period, immediately after the bombing?
Immediately after the attack, and once, you know, it was finished and the families were evacuated to safety, now this territory of Hawaii had set up plans. So keep in mind, we knew that Japan could attack, and they were making plans, training in Red Cross, where families would evacuate to. It was like equivalent to today's civil defense. What they couldn't figure out, though, was the timing, what would happen. So the surprise was the attack was a surprise, the timing of it, but not the fact that it could ever happen.
Right.
So now you have families that are now at these places of sheltering in place, right? Now they need to figure out, where do we go from here? So announcements were made to get to places like the Oahu Country Club, University of Hawaii, to private homes. Maybe the person who was the help at their house who came in on the weekend said, come to our home, we'll take you in. And many of them were Japanese Americans. So now families in this massive exodus in the cities and towns of Oahu for safety. And they're kept there until it was safe to come back to the base once bomb shelters were made, and they didn't have much time because they had time to leave Oahu because of the safety and welfare of them. Now the military wanted them out of harm's way, and so thus began their evacuation of Hawaii, either by clipper ship or by boat. The biggest one was Christmas Eve, leaving Hawaii in a massive convoy with the Navy. These opulent ships that were the ships that came home, that they came to Hawaii on, are now being refabricated to be troop ships with the wounded and many of the women and children packed like sardines with midget submarines of water zigzagging, trying to get to San Francisco or Los Angeles. So there was this, way where these children, some did go back to their houses, some didn't, some lost their fathers. It's just very sad that for every family, there is a common denominator, and then for others, there's just this very tragic accommodating that we had to deal with because of the loss of their father, who was military, and what it did to the mother. And now she's a widow, and she has these children, and now you have to figure out now I have to leave. So that is what I found very fascinating, is that no one talked about, in all of the books that I've read in high school and college on Pearl Harbor, September, what happened to the women and children? What did they experience? What did they go through?
Right.
So this information has been very valuable to now tell that story.
Hmm.
And there are Pearl Harbor survivors that were military, but the association never included in their membership spouses and children.
Right.
So you have these descendants that are offspring of a Pearl Harbor survivor who was married, or they just didn't have kids at the time. And then you have these children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I put them in the category as a survivor or witness, is what they call them now. But they are a 7 December survivor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even if they were an infant, I just wanted them to know that I consider them and their experiences equal to the veteran that, you know, serving, even though their lives were in harm's way, but still consider the children an important story of the 7 December event.
Well, and switching gears slightly, but you were talking about the veterans now. You've met many of the veterans who were stationed here when Pearl Harbor was bombed. They've come back for ceremonies or to see, where they served. You've even met some of their children who were not here during Pearl Harbor, but have come consequently afterwards with their dads and moms for ceremonies and reminiscences. And so you've been collecting their stories as well, and you've created relationships with these Pearl Harbor and Oahu families.
Yes.
So I'm thinking now, a lot of our listeners have older relations who have amazing stories that should be recorded. How do you get, I'm talking about your veterans now, but how do you get people in general to open up about events and maybe even traumatic events they've experienced?
It took time, it took trust,
mm-hmm.
and it took to where the survivors understood that I knew the history.
Mm-hmm.
That I knew the squadron they were in, I knew where they were in the barracks, I knew what planes they flew, I knew who were their friends, I knew who they lost in their squadron. So it became to where they were like, wow, she's not just asking an open-ended questions here, she knows me.
Mm-hmm.
She knows what I experienced. She knows where I ate my meals, where I used to go to the beach, the places I hung out in Waikiki and downtown. So over time, they knew that I was very well-versed in knowing their life. And that opened the trust, and it actually helped them jog their memory. Many of them, if I could mention, are centennials.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And having been their friends for over a decade now, it's like as if they can live the past, not just December 7th, but they will always admit that the Japanese ruined it and the war happened. Mm-hmm. Nothing can take away the love and admiration and just the love of Hawaii that they had living here. And they keep coming back, not just to honor 7 December,
mm-hmm.
but they come back because a piece of them, a piece of their heart was planted here
uh-huh.
in the Hawaiian Islands. And so it's trust. And I think knowing that they can tell their stories and I know what they're talking about, that brings a lot of comfortableness for the survivor,
mm-hmm.
because you have to be careful. Many of them experience today what we have a clinical diagnosis for, and mm-hmm. it's post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right, right.
Then don't even want to, you know, I think what I know best about my survivors is I know when to ask certain questions and when not to. Many of them don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about the attack because that's all they're asked. All these years of December 7th, all the media wants to do is have them tell that horrible story over and over again.
Right.
What I'm interested in many times are the good stories too. And it's, you just have to know the veteran well enough to know how to navigate when you interview.
Well, so if I'm hearing you correctly, then it might be helpful to somebody who wants to ask a grandmother or grandfather who served to do some research around their, they know their grandfather was stationed in, I don't know, Spain or something, to do some preliminary research so that there's a kind of a framework so they can help ask intelligent questions that might lead to more story, is what you're saying. With, like with these Pearl Harbor survivors, if you know more about what happened in context, you can help prompt memories from them.
And yes.
Yeah, I think that that was very profound what you said. I hadn't really thought of that before. So do your research before you ask somebody, and then you're going to get a better wealth of information. And I think you're absolutely right. I don't think I hear too many reporters ask, why do you like Hawaii? They always ask things like, so what were you doing on that day in Pearl Harbor? So they do. They continually are... only having to remember the negative. That's very
correct.
Yeah. So,
and you have to. What survivors told me, and they call them heroes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association initially was created, it wasn't to honor themselves; it was to honor the true heroes who were killed in action. Okay. And over time, he turned them into rock stars, which is understandable. But for some of them, they felt that it was just too much. Don't honor me. I didn't do anything special. What they found out is that talent, talent and giftedness had nothing to do with survivorship. It didn't matter how fast you ran, where you decided to take shelter, or how you manned a machine gun, or how great of a pilot you were. It basically came down to fate. So they felt like, why you honor me when I survived and these guys gave their lives? I was a lucky one. Talent had nothing to do with it. So therefore, why are you bestowing me with this, title? And I had to understand that, because I was trained as, no different than any other historian, to treat them like they're a hero. And if they don't have a hero story to tell, one of them could have been taking shelter behind a shed or behind a hibiscus bush until it was safe to come out with his 45 caliber pistol or to man the 30 caliber 50 caliber machine gun. So you just have to know the history in order to sometimes really get a deeper interview with the survivors. And I think with the children, it skips a generation. I have found that more grandchildren are successful in asking the grandfather or great-grandfather questions in an interview than their own children.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because it's removed, right? There's some maybe regrets that they have that they weren't the best father because of these war experiences. That when their children had children, now grandparenthood became a second chance to do it right. And to be able to share that, because the children may not have known what it's like when the grandfather was young and battling through the demons, And I think it brings a lot of healing when you see these grandchildren interviewing their grandfather, and their mom and dad, who is the child of this veteran, is now seeing healing that's taking place, and now they understand why their father, mother was a certain way because of their traumatic experiences. So that's what I've been finding the beauty in these younger generation grandchildren that are really doing an incredible service to their family's history by taking that opportunity where grandpa now is ready to talk.
Wow. Yeah. You've done a lot of history talks, and I've been following you on some of the ones that are online. I know you've created a dossier of many of the families who lived on Oahu during World War II, and you actually located someone who we have a letter from in our museum. And so I definitely see several more podcasts happening throughout the year, November, Month of the Military Family, Pearl Harbor Day, etc. I'd like for you to explain to our listeners why it's important for you to, now let's steer back to the kids, tell the kids' story or the family story. I have an answer for when people ask me why our museum does what it does and why our stories matter, but I'd like you to tell why you think it's important to preserve the ancillary stories, the families, the spouses, the kids, the parents.
Right. It is very important because, as a historian, we are trained to look at the military documents, end of action report, chronologies for the command. Mm-hmm. And what's missing is the personal aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So if you only know about what that individual did while he was active duty military on that day of 7 December or through the war, you don't get to know his personal life. So that was, for me, always like a missing link. I couldn't get to know this veteran unless I really knew about his family. So that is where I realized that there were many who were interviewed. So newspapers from their hometown became important. What his wife was doing with the children during the war. And was she the one that worked in the factory or helped with Red Cross? You know, that whole element of the family. To also go to where now you have Gordon Prang, Dr. Goldstein, Walter Lord, who now wrote these prolific books about 7 December and now starting to interview them and their spouses. So then you have these oral histories, like at North Texas University, that now not just talk about him as the military person, but also they ask questions about the family. So now it was like you can get a very balanced under human aspect story about these military who served on 7 December. And that is for me why I focus so much in finding the children and looking at newspaper articles that talked about the home front.
Yeah.
It is very important for us, not as a military historian, but for me, and what I want to focus on, and that is completing the story for these families who had loved ones that served, the family, if he had one, that would be a missing link if you don't include it.
Well, and you know, I imagine that you hear some pretty sad things. When people are telling you their story, they may tell you something that's sad or something that might be controversial or maybe even semi-classified. How do you relay that information to your audiences or when you're writing up your dossier without offending or upsetting people that you may be telling the stories to, but yet you're not erasing or diluting that part of history? How do you walk that balance?
That's a hard one, Circe, and it's case by case, right? Mm-hmm. So if the family wants to ask me, and I can tell that they know, but they just want to hear it from me or what I know about the situation, suicide or PTSD or got in trouble during the war for something or, you know, I'll mention it because they're asking. Will I voluntarily throw it out there knowing they have no idea? No. I just feel that something sometimes, I can't validate it either, so I don't know if I would want to bring up something that I know the family is unaware of, and of course, trust the source where I got it from.
Right.
But I just had that situation recently, giving a family the history of who lived in their house December 7th, and the person who lived in the home was a lieutenant at the time of the attack, but would finish out his career as a rear admiral, and he, his life. And I am careful because if they research now this family who I now told lived in their house, I ask them to please be respectful and not to. But I have to be careful because if they choose on their own time to want to look into this and find the next of kin, I really am careful because I don't want that to be a question that they ask them. Oh, by the way, I heard that, you know, he shot himself. You know, do you think that was a part of PTSD or, you know, was there a scandal? So that's where if it doesn't produce good seed, I think it's worth planting. So, but if it's to help a family heal because they know and they just need to hear it from me in my interpretation, then that's helpful and it's constructive and it's healing, then by every means I will share. I will engage with them if I feel that is where it's headed.
Okay. Well, that is a dilemma we have as historians, And so I'm glad that you explained it, because it shows that you really care. And I appreciate that. So I wanted to, and it was funny because we're working on Zoom here, and well, we're working on remote, and I'm having the doorbell ring and the dogs barking, so I got a little distracted just now. Thinking back to your own childhood, did you ever think you would be a subject matter expert in military family history, specifically about World War II? Would your history teacher in high school have predicted this?
Probably not. You know, it wasn't until probably high school before I started college that I wanted to Connie Chun, the journalist, the special reporter, special stories, more personalized, and I was ready to go to the University of Maryland journalism school. Mm-hmm. But then I lost my brother in high school my senior year, and that kind of changed the trajectory of what I needed to do. And then my grandmother suffered a stroke, so I told my parents they're too young to retire back to Hawaii. So my mom was, you know, finding a way to heal, but to take one burden off her mind, I came to Hawaii to take care of my grandmother who had the stroke. And I went a different route, you know. So I enjoyed history. It was more not 7 December or World War II. It was more Hawaiian and Japanese cultural history that I was interested in. And it was through an internship. So when I went back to Japan to see my parents, I would make sure that I could do kill two birds with one stone. So I would do an internship at Stars and Stripes in Tokyo, the Far East Network on the Okode Air Base, just to get some background, hands-on experience in journalism. And then for some reason, I did an internship at the Hickam Air Force Base History Office with a wonderful mentor, friend, Leotris Arakaki, who wrote the only book at the time about Hickam. And he says, you ought to put your name in the hat when you graduate to, you know, maybe the Park Service might be hiring for December 7th. And that's what I did. I put my name in the hat for an internship program, temporary position. And that sealed the deal. That 50th remembrance in 1991 as young little park ranger Jesse really sealed the deal. And I knew at that point, this is what I wanted to do. But then military wifehood came along. So I did take a hiatus until my kids were back in school and I could do this full time as a volunteer. Hey, so that's kind of the course that I took to get where I am today.
Hey, so listen, I have to go really quick. I'm going to put you on pause and pause because this is the wonder of being online. I've got to answer the door.
Okay.
So hang on.
Okay.
So, thank you so much for hanging on there. That's the beauty about doing remote things. I just wanted to ask you, in the few minutes we have left, what other things would you like our listeners to know about the children on Oahu? Well, the everybody on Oahu at that time.
Correct, because you also, it's important to understand about the other children on this island that also either experienced loss or even sacrifice in supporting the military after the attack. So my grandfather sadly lost his own brother and 6-month-old baby niece. They were sitting on their front porch when word of the attack was announced, and I guess they were curious, and so he comes outside, and sadly an anti-aircraft shell from Honolulu, one of the battleships, fails to explode in the air like it's supposed to as anti-aircraft shelling. And it landed in front of the house, killing him and the baby. So we lost two family members on 7 December, and there were many others. There were well over 50 other civilians that were killed by friendly fire that I didn't know about until I became a park ranger. And my grandfather, he might have known or didn't know, but when I told him, he was like, oh, the Japanese never bombed downtown. And I was like, well, a bomb, if it was like the size of the ones that were landing all around Hickam Field, would have been at least a 550-pounder, and those would have left more damage. You know, these were anti-aircraft, 3 or 5-inch shell type, and people mistake those for bombs. But they did burn down buildings. They did cause bodily harm and injury. And so it is the child story that's also missing are the many children who were killed by friendly fire. Mm. And it's something that maybe is difficult to talk about, but even those that were even lost an arm, or when that shrapnel blowing up from those shells, you're talking about stuff that's blowing up on the ground and also overhead. Mm. A piece of shrapnel falling down from a couple hundred feet from the air. So that's what I feel was also missing, is understanding that there were many children on Oahu that experienced loss, mm-hmm. injury, tragedy, a whole family that was wiped out because of that shell hitting the house and causing a fire. Mm-hmm. See, where they had to move in, let military move in with them. I can't imagine people talking, well, what do you mean I got to share my clothes, my food, with this total stranger,
Right.
So there is that aspect of understanding that the entire island of Oahu, all of its citizens were affected, and even some of the outer islands that were being shelled by Japanese submarines as well, just isolated to Oahu. Mm. And it really gives you a broader understanding of 7 December, not just Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. That's the name we chose to give it, because that was the epicenter and the largest loss of life. But we have to be, in many ways, true to the history and making sure that we let visitors understand the ripple effect of the entire community island that was affected.
So what other islands were bombed or attacked around that time? Because you said outer islands, like the Big Island or Maui?
It is Maui. We had, so there were Japanese other midget submarines that were harassing other islands, whether it was during that morning or later in the day or at night. Mm-hmm. But there is a fact, some of the outer islands experienced the Japanese attack as well, coming mm-hmm. from the waters, from their midget submarines. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, definitely we could do a whole nother podcast on things we didn't know. Well, it has been absolutely a fascinating conversation with you today.
Sorry, don't mean to interrupt you, but yes, even Niihau, so that's another story about the Japanese, aviator that landed on the private island of Niihau, which we call the Niihau Incident. And so, yes, so there's... It's not just Oahu, so yes, we got lots to talk about then in the future.
no doubt, because I mean, we also should mention, and we won't do it now, except I'm just going to allude into it, and if you could do like a 2-second thing, but Japanese American families were rounded up and put in internment camps right here in on Oahu, and I imagine other Hawaiian islands as well. So those children. And families were, destroyed as well by the actions on that day.
It wasn't just Japanese American. There was German families, Austrian, Italian.
Mm-hmm.
They rounded up anybody who was considered like a possible enemy, saboteur, the columnist. So it was devastating. Where we had to go and round up people that we thought were a possible threat. And it was illegal, it was unconstitutional, but, we're under martial law,
mm-hmm.
so the military and the forces that may be, like FBI or, any other agency on Oahu that felt it was for the safety of the island that they did that. And it wasn't just Honouliuli, there was Sand Island. I mean, it was like there were two places on Oahu, and they were rounding up people, but majority of them were Japanese American.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have been anything from, Japanese businessmen to priests to fishermen. So mm-hmm. yeah, that would be a whole other story about how we had to do such a horrible act of discrimination and judgment
mm-hmm.
at that time that mm-hmm. we felt was the right thing to do, when in hindsight we now know how devastating it was for those families.
Well, and that goes back to my question about, how do you tell history without offending anyone or upsetting anyone, but yet not erasing or diluting that part of history? I mean, we can't deny that we rounded up people and, held them against their wishes. And it's part of our history. And You know, so I think as historians, we are obligated to tell these, you know, somewhat unsettling stories as well.
You see, it's the delivery of the message, right?
Yeah.
So I believe that if you create a good way of bringing it to light,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
they bring it to the light, which there's truth and transparency.
Right.
So I will never lie. Mm-hmm. I will always tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when the truth can be given at a time that it was seen as the light and not the darkness.
Right.
And we have to make sure that we can tell the truth. And many times I'll tell a family, you know, would it be possible to meet with you? I wanted to talk about something else. And, you know, so if that's not the right moment,
mm-hmm.
then
mm-hmm.
I'll plan to at least deliver that important truth when it needs to be. I don't mm-hmm. believe in hiding it away, because now today things come to the surface, mm-hmm. and then people become very defensive, and then they want to avenge the injustice, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's when mm-hmm. I have to make sure that generations later, you know, we need to reveal it, because I would hate for them to find out and there's no one else alive,
right,
who would have did
right.
to tell the story,
right?
And so, yeah,
yeah,
we are very true. It's a role we play, but it's always in truth. I always believe in always telling the truth.
Well, we belong to, our museum belongs to the American Association for State and Local History, and they are always talking about ethics, and they're always talking about good history, you know, having good history principles, which is transparent, is respectful, is factual, which is not incendiary. So, yeah. Well, I wanted to thank you so much, and I'm sorry for the disruption in the middle of this, but I also needed to thank our supporters, some of the organizations that support our podcasts, our New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. So thank you so much, Jesse. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, seriously, mahalo, and to your organization and for what you folks stand for and what you do. I'm so happy to have met you, and to partner with you, and help and collaborate.
Well, there's going to be lots more of that happening, but I wanted to thank you very much. And
mahalo.
Aloha.